Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Yen. I'm the LACNETS Director of Programs and Outreach, as well as a caregiver and advocate for my husband who is living with NET. In each podcast episode, we talk to a NET expert who answers your top 10 questions. This podcast is for educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Please discuss your questions and concerns with your physician. Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm really excited to introduce today's guest, Dr. Hagen Kenneke. Dr. Kenneke is a medical oncologist specializing in neuroendocrine tumors and rectal cancer. Dr. Kenneke received his medical degree and completed his residency and oncology training in Canada, and he was in Vancouver before moving to Seattle, Washington, to become the medical director of the Virginia Mason Cancer Center. In March 2021, he moved to the Portland area to become the medical director of gastrointestinal oncology at Providence. He's passionate about finding new therapeutics for patients with neuroendocrine tumors. Dr. Kenneke has served as a member of the National Cancer Institute of Canada, the NCI of Canada, the CTG GI Site Committee, and the Neuroendocrine Tumor Task Force of the NCI GI Steering Committees. He serves as the co-chair of the Southwest Oncology Group, SWOG, Rectal Anal Cancer Subcommittee, and is the immediate past chair of the Rectal Anal Task Force of the U.S. National Cancer Institute. I'm really excited to have Dr. Kenneke here with us today because we met last year at the NANETS in Portland, and I've been cyber-stalking him for a while on Twitter. I'm just excited to have an opportunity to pick your brain about some things that you're passionate about and I know well-versed in. One fun fact I want to share about Dr. Kenneke is that he lives in Hood River, about 20 minutes from Mount Hood, where he has 10 cows and 3 calves. So much fun. So Dr. Kenneke, welcome. And I'd like to invite you to share how you got involved with the neuroendocrine tumor community.
Lisa, thanks so much. And it's been a pleasure to be invited here. And I feel like we've known each other a lot longer than a year. LACNETS is a great patient organization. And how did I get involved? I mean, how do you not get involved? You know, the patient community is so engaged, engaging, and important in this disease site more than any other cancer type. You know, many of the organizations that are out there right now, like NANETS, you know, they were founded by patients. So I think if you're going to do NETS, you got to be engaged. So happy to be part of it all.
Thanks for being engaged in NETS. And what first attracted you to NETS? How did you get involved in treating NET patients and in research for NETS?
I think NETS are definitely a thinking specialty. Sometimes it's a mystery. Sometimes it's a puzzle. There's a lot of syndromes, even today with all the testing, you know, patients having, you know, flushing or peripheral neuropathy. And there's a lot of unanswered questions still in NETS. And that's really what got me interested in it. And it's a very international disease site, isn't it? We learned so much from the Europeans early in my NET career. I went to Sweden to visit Dr. Kyle Oberg to understand their PRRT program and their treatment program. I have about half a dozen patients that I sent there way back when, before we had PRRT in North America. So I think all those things, and most importantly, you know, the patient community, we can make a difference by talking to patients, spending the time and understanding what's going on with their specific cancer, because they're all different.
I love how you have all this curiosity to try to find answers for unanswered questions.
Yeah, it's what's part of it, right?
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that. And so with that, talking about unanswered questions, why don't we get started with our 10 questions?
Fantastic. Want to fire them out or?
I will.
I didn't memorize them all. So.
Okay. Well, one thing I want to say, sometimes in our patient education meetings, we tend to be lumpers. We put all NETS together. However, as you and I have talked about briefly, not all NETS are the same, right? And there are people who, not only are we all individuals, but the types of NET kind of matter. So in this series, we're trying to be separators and separate out the different types of NET because sometimes it matters. And so there might be specific nuances to it that might be helpful for patients to understand. So today we're going to really tackle the topic of appendix and hindgut NETs. So the first question is, what are hindgut NETs? Where are they located? And what are the different types of hindgut NETs? And also, does it include appendix NET? Where does an appendix NET fit in everything?
Great question. And I love your splitter analogy, lumpers versus splitters. And I agree with you. NETs are, it's a histology-defined cancer, right? And you can get NETs pretty much anywhere. And they're tied together by their commonality when it comes to biology, what they look like under the microscope. But it's like almost like real estate. Location matters and anatomy matters. And for the hindgut gnats, the anatomy is the hindgut embryologically, which includes the latter part actually only of the large bowel. But for discussion purposes, we include all of the colon and the rectum and the hindguts. Where do appendix fit? Well, appendix just so happens to hang off the right colon, off the cecum. And appendix has its own space, has its own real estate as a lone standing tumor in the classification system. I'm happy to discuss them. We discussed before this call today that it's a really exciting area with a lot of new data and important data that we have to treat our patients. So that's really where appendix sits.
Hey, thanks. So since there's various types of hindgut, the colon and rectum, how are they found? And what are the symptoms of a hindgut gnat? And then we can also talk about appendix as well.
So unfortunately, most gnats are asymptomatic until a more advanced stage. And that is for many reasons, probably partially because they do grow so slowly and the body gets used to them being there. Sometimes we are able to detect them early because they send us signals like bleeding. Gnats are very vascular, and because of that, they can bleed if the tumor originates in the hindgut. And I've had patients that presented with formidable bleeds and eventually were diagnosed with a neuroendocrine tumor of the hindgut. So another advantage of the hindgut gnats is they can be detected early because they're in the same real estate location, if we want to take that analogy further, as the colorectal tumors, aren't they? So if you do your colonoscopy, and remember the age of screening is now 45, even if you don't have a family history, you may also be diagnosed with a neuroendocrine tumor, and hopefully an early stage one if you have to be diagnosed with it. So that is a main area of detecting them, if you will. Obviously, when it comes to staging, we also need to do CT scanning and dotatate scan, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later on. In terms of the appendix and gnats are, it's almost impossible to screen for them. They are almost like appendicitis. It presents itself with pain. A lot of appendix gnats present initially as appendicitis. What it looks like under a CT scan is swelling and mass of the appendix. And then the surgeon goes in and takes out the appendix thinking that's just good old appendicitis. And lo and behold, there's a tumor in there. And that leads to a whole bunch of other questions. But in terms of detection and symptoms, we generally see either asymptomatic GI bleeds, abdominal pain, change in bowel habits. We don't generally see carcinoid syndrome because you need to have liver metastases. Almost always you have a much more advanced disease if you have carcinoid. So just a kind of a flushing syndrome in the absence of anything else wouldn't necessarily point to an early stage hindgut gnat.
That's helpful. So, you know, you mentioned that hindgut can be found on colonoscopies and then there's other scans, appendix, it's hard to detect. What types of lab scans and testing can be done to, I guess, further work up if someone has a hindgut gnat and then also appendix gnat?
We do want to have good staging investigation, which is a high quality CT, a multiphase CT of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, if indeed there's a diagnosis of a neuroendocrine tumor in the hindgut. And almost always, if you do have a gnat that is anything but a very, very small gnat of the hindgut, I do like to offer a dotatate PET CT, as that is more sensitive when it comes to staging and documenting absence of disease. Blood tests are sometimes helpful, but generally we're not relying on them too much when it comes to staging. I think it's reasonable, particularly if there are symptoms, to order a urinary 5-HIAA, chromogranin A, lots of false positives as well as false negatives. So controversial whether that's a requirement, but I think doing it once at baseline, particularly if you haven't done surgery to remove the tumor yet, that'll tell you whether or not it's the type of tumor that secretes chromogranin A, it would be a reasonable thing. And doing it after surgery as well, if you did it before, or either way. And beyond that, those would be the predominant things to do. Obviously, virtually all patients in the course of their diagnosis will have had a high quality colonoscopy. If we're looking at the whole bowel, we know that NETs can be multifocal. So that is the role for the colonoscopy.
Yeah, thanks for that overview for the hindgut NETs. What about appendix NET? And could you also discuss why people with appendix NET often have such a challenging time getting a diagnosis?
Well, the appendix is this little thing hanging off the cecum, and you can't see it with any other modality besides a CT scan. So if you have an early stage appendix NET and it's not blocking anything off, you're pretty much going to miss it all the time on pretty much any modality you do, besides perhaps a PET CT dotatate, but you need to have at least a 1 centimeter tumor. In terms of what's missed, what happens is these tumors, again, much like appendicitis, they declare themselves by obstructing the lumen of the appendix. So for that, you have to have a certain size and causing discomfort. And we know that appendicitis can sometimes be chronic. So patients who eventually are diagnosed with appendix NET often describe a history of episodic abdominal pain, which could reflect the episodic obstruction of the appendiceal lumen. And kind of putting it all together retrospectively, then that kind of explains why it took so long to get a diagnosis. It is a tricky spot to see anatomically for sure.
Yeah, it is tricky. And it seems, I don't know about the incidence and the age range, but it seems like a lot of people tend to be on the younger side.
On the young side, yes. There's actually papers published on children with appendiceal NETs diagnosed. And the question comes up about what should their management be, including surgery?
Yeah, we will circle back to that because I know that's a hot topic. So the next question is, how is rectal NET different from rectal cancer? I know that that's something that you're well versed in as well. And what are some ways that hindgut NETs also are different from other types of NETs, and what makes rectal NET so unique?
Okay, you touched on two of my most favorite topics, NETs and rectal malignancies. So this is a big one. And then the big difference with rectal NETs is where they are. Biologically, they are generally similar to a NET, for example, that originates in the small bowel. There's some sense that sometimes they can be a little more aggressive, including a higher Ki-67. And the other big difference between the rectal NETs is where they arise. They arise essentially in the pelvis, in the bowel that goes through the terminal part of the colon. It goes through the pelvis, and the pelvis is a busy area. There's the reproductive organs, the bowel, the bladder, and lymph nodes and vasculature. And for that reason, they are harder to definitively remove without causing a whole bunch of side effects, including a permanent ostomy. They are also harder sometimes to detect whether or not there's a regional node involvement. So they do present a very diagnostic and therapeutic challenge. So I've been privileged to ask to chair the NANETS guidelines for treatment and management and diagnosis of rectal NETs. And over the past 6 months, we put together a national task force of a very multidisciplinary group that has been tasked for establishing some standards of how to manage rectal NETs. And in that process, we've really uncovered a whole lot of questions that we need to answer. We've put together a Delphi survey, and we're surveying a group of experts in the field to establish the standards. And what really struck me is that there is quite a bit of variability in how these tumors are treated.
Yeah, I forgot to mention in the beginning that you were chairing the guidelines committee for those guidelines. And what an important area to really establish some guidelines, since it can be hard to find some data around this. So what also makes it different from other types of NET? You mentioned it's a higher Ki-67. What else makes it unique?
Yeah, let's talk about, you know, what's the diagnostic workup and management of a rectal NET. So what's different about them is that you do need to establish carefully tumor stage, and that includes a pelvic MRI that is used to look at the tumor depth and surrounding nodes. And that's really important because that allows us to determine whether or not a more aggressive surgery is required, or we can have an endoscopic treatment. Do we need a PET CT scan? If on a rectal MRI or CT, we see some pelvic nodes or tissues that we're suspicious about, a PET CT should definitely be done. I myself have been surprised by what looks like a very early stage rectal NET. And we saw a potential slightly enlarged node. We did a dotatate scan, and indeed it was positive. So that actually changed treatment towards a surgery rather than endoscopy. So once the diagnosis is established, a big question comes up about, do you need a full rectal surgery or can you remove this tumor transrectally or endoscopically? And that's really important because one of the implications of one is potentially a permanent bag, or even if it's a surgical removal, that can have some consequences like LARS. So a lot of the literature around rectal NETs is currently looking at, when can we do a endoscopy and who should do it? So endoscopic removal of the tumors versus excision. And so there's kind of two big players when it comes to therapy. There's the gastroenterologist, then there's the colorectal surgeons. And the gastroenterologists are really slick at excising these tumors with an endoscopy, or sometimes they inject some saline underneath the tumor to kind of lift it off of the bowel and then excise it more cleanly. Whereas colorectal surgeons, their expertise is a full thickness excision of the entire tumor and the surrounding tissue. So there is some controversial, if you like, as to when should you just have these removed by a gastroenterologist and when by a surgeon. And among the surgical community is, when should you just do the full thickness excision versus the full rectal removal and all the surrounding nodes. So that's really one of the focuses of these guidelines. In terms of what we know now, we know that if the tumors are smaller and we don't see any evidence of nodes on the staging that I just mentioned, then indeed a kind of endoscopic, so an excision or full thickness removal of just the tumor may be possible with excellent long-term outcomes. And then the next question is, what's the cut point? Is it 1 centimeter? Is it 2 centimeters? Do we have to look at lymphovascular invasion and Ki-67? And all of those factors are important, but size is actually a big driver. And it does seem like for tumors that are 2 centimeters or less, that's really the area where we probably, in many situations, can get away with just a local regional removal as opposed to a big surgery with all the surrounding nodes. So that's the big difference when it comes to managing rectal NETs.
Wow. Thank you so much for explaining that. And that actually goes into my next question about hindgut NETs and surgery. You already covered rectal NETs. What about the other kinds of hindgut, so colon, and then also appendix? How do you decide if it can be surgically removed, and what type of surgeon or specialist would make that determination?
You know, surgery really is a primary modality to cure these tumors. And colorectal surgeons obviously specialize in anything to do with primarily the large bowel, the hindgut, as well as the small bowel. Where I practice, you know, one of the reasons I work where I work is we have a large group of excellent colorectal surgeons. And for all these complex cases, which I've really never met a NET patients, which isn't complex in the sense that you're always trying to individualize the treatment and figure out what is the best thing for this particular patient. So we really rely on the colorectal surgeons. If you don't have a colorectal surgeon in your area, you could get referred. There are excellent general surgeons out there that treat lots of colon tumors as well as appendix. I will say, more and more on a national basis, rectal surgery, anything rectum, when it comes to surgery, we probably should have a colorectal surgeon doing that.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that explanation. And how do you decide if the colon or rectal ones can be surgically removed?
Size is important. If they are larger tumors in the rectum, or if the tumor is in the colon, the issue with the colon is if you excise a polyp and then you want to see next year, is there any evidence of it coming back locally? It's a little hard to find the spot where you removed it. So the general practice for colonic tumors, you do a surgery and it's definitive and you remove the tumor and where it was and all the regional nodes. There's much less functional implications of doing a colonic surgery versus a rectal surgery. So that's really the big determinant, where it is and the size. This is probably a great segue to the appendix controversy. And when do you need a hemicolectomy for appendiceal cancers? And let me tell you, I have presented at all of the institutions where I've worked, this has always been a perennial area of questions. And every single patient with an appendiceal NET should be presented at a tumor board, either a NET tumor board or a colorectal tumor board. We need to do a pathology review of the appendix cancer. We need to look exactly how big is it. We need to look not only how big is it in terms of dimensions, but how deep it went into the what we call the mesoappendix, which is kind of the final barrier between the appendix and the abdominal cavity. And there are criteria that have been used. And kind of way back when, the rule was if you had an appendix NET that was a centimeter or more, you automatically need a right hemicolectomy. And then there's been more data that said if it's less than 2 centimeters, you probably don't need a right hemicolectomy. You can just remove the appendix, which you can do with a minimally invasive surgery. It doesn't require removal of the bowel. And there's been a very good recent publication, a large study with long follow-up. We're getting closer and closer to really moving the bar to 2 centimeters, saying that if you have an appendix cancer that has been completely removed, then margins are negative. You don't see high risk features. It's not a G3 NET. It's a true NET. It's not a goblet. Goblet carcinoids are not carcinoids. Those have been renamed, by the way. And that's the other great thing about the new classification system. We've cleaned up appendix cancers and we have appendix NETs. And the appendix NETs are neuroendocrine tumors and they have to be well differentiated. They can't have mucinous histologies. They can't have any of the neuroendocrine carcinoma features. And the things that used to be called appendiceal carcinoids should not be called that anymore. They're called appendiceal adenocarcinomas. And the reason they are is they're adenocarcinomas and they need to be managed completely different and they do require usually a right hemicolectomy. But if indeed you have a true appendiceal NET and is less than 2 centimeters, it's been completely removed, you probably don't need a right hemicolectomy. So again, tumor board, you need experts in the field, ideally colorectal surgeons or experienced general surgeons who have managed appendiceal NETs in the past.
Ah, thank you for that fantastic overview. And we'll make sure to have the NANETS guidelines of Hindgut NET in our podcast page as a resource, as well as this study that you're referring to. So, you know, after people talk to a surgeon or talk to a NET specialist and then gotten through surgery, how are hindgut NETs treated medically or non-surgically?
Our good friend Eric Liu, I do like what he says, surgery, surgery, surgery. In terms of sequence, that's always the first question. You know, can you remove it? Okay, once you've answered that, then the question is, well, what else do you need? And I think the way to think about that is it advanced or is it early stage? If it's early stage malignancy, you know, surgery is definitive. You don't need adjuvant therapy. We're doing some trials in adjuvant therapy for PNETs now, as you well know, but there's no role for doing anything else or sequencing of therapy for tumors that are completely resected. When it comes to treatment of advanced tumors, many of the principles that we have for other NETs in terms of sequencing of therapy do apply for the hindguts. So if they are somatostatin analog positive, we do want to make sure they're treated with somatostatin analog treatments. So if the DOTATATE scan is positive, we do know that whether it's the midguts that the NETTO trial was done in, or hindgut tumors, as long as they're DOTATATE positive on PET CT and the Krenning score is 2 or above, we know that they benefit from Lutathera or the upcoming alpha emitters are all being done, including the hindguts. In terms of other therapy, chemotherapy, similarly to midgut tumors, these are not generally tumors that are chemosensitive. So I would save any chemotherapy like CAPTEM or FOLFOX, unless you have no other options, unless there's no trial, unless you feel like the patient's going to benefit, I would save the chemotherapy or defer it completely. Obviously, small molecule therapy is under active investigation. We talked about our good friend Jen Chan. She's doing the cabozantinib trial, the cabinet trial of cabozantinib versus placebo with crossover. So that may very well be a treatment that we can offer patients as well when we answered that question.
Yeah, so similar to other NETs, except for the exception of chemo, it sounds like. What about appendix NET? How are they treated medically or non-surgically, and how are they sequenced?
I think that's similar with the appendix. The diagnosis is crucial, right? Because in the past, we have kind of lumped appendix histologies. We've mixed them up too much. So we do need to always review that pathology and make sure it's a true NET. And if it is indeed a true NET, then you go back to somatostatin analogs, radioligand therapy, small molecule therapy. Generally, appendix NETs, if anything, there's a tendency for them to be less aggressive and less likely to metastasize. We haven't talked about surveillance. Maybe there's a question coming up on that. And that's an important question. But we generally also don't use chemotherapy for that patient population.
Okay. And my next question was actually, how are the treatments different from other NETs? And I think you've already covered this. They're basically the same somatostatin analogs, PRRT, the small molecule medications, and
everolimus, of course, very important option. And that is included in the small molecule treatments.
Yeah. So really, with exception of chemotherapy, they're similar.
Yeah.
So yeah, you were just mentioning surveillance. That is my next question. How are the hindgut NETs monitored and how are the appendix NETs monitored? What type of blood works or tests might you do? And what's the best scan for hindgut NET?
Well, we talked about appendix a lot, so why don't we continue with that? The appendix is a little more complicated because the question with the appendix is, do you do surgery or don't you do surgery? And then if you do surgery and they didn't have any metastasis to the nodes, then just like hindgut NETs, you likely do not need to do any follow-up CT scans because the risk of subsequent relapse is low. If this was a node-positive appendix NET, then you really should be doing a CT scan. You should be doing a CT scan at least once a year, a high-quality abdomen pelvis CT scan, and that should be continued out to 10 years because we know that stage 3 NET cancers can relapse late, and they can happen out to 10 years. What about hindgut NETs that have been completely resected? Similar principle, annual CT if they were node positive. The other question is, if they were a small appendix NET and you didn't do surgery, so you just removed the appendix and you didn't do surgery because there were not factors that you thought they were at high risk of recurrence or had any significant risk of recurrence, do you need to do a CT scan? And there's opinion that's variable there. But my general approach is if you didn't think that the tumor was high enough risk to relapse to do surgery, then you don't need to do imaging to detect recurrence because they're not at risk, at any significant risk of recurrence. You're really not doing surgery only if the patient isn't at significant risk. And if they're not at significant risk of relapse, then you don't need to do imaging. So that's a discussion with a patient. And I generally like to offer people a follow-up CT scan a year after their surgery, regardless of whether it's node positive or negative, so that we have some follow-up. So we have a baseline scan. And so we make sure everything that needs to be done has been done, including a colonoscopy. And so that's my approach.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So the last question is, what clinical trials should we be aware of or exciting new treatments that are in the pipeline for hindgut NETs and then also appendix NETs?
There's lots going on in NETs, and trials are such an important part of treatment. And I would say to patients, if there's any trial, always look at it. Trial is a great way to get excellent care and in some cases gain access to a treatment that you wouldn't otherwise. Also, my advice would be ask lots of questions and you got to be selfish. You have to say, do the trial if it's right for you. And always ask your doctor, if I didn't do this trial, what would you do for me? And so I think that's really important. I'm a huge fan of trials. I'm looking forward to talking about some of the trials that we're doing and we have specifically at Providence Cancer Institute, but it's got to work for the patients. In terms of the upcoming trials, we are really excited about retreatment with PRRT, with radioligand therapy. We are really excited about the alpha emitters, both in first line and in the retreatment setting. And we have trials coming up in both. We have systemic treatments with the small molecule agents. I would love to see more data on what is the role of resecting the primary? What is the role of resecting appendiceal tumors? Unfortunately, we just don't have trials for that. It's a difficult setting to do studies in, and that's really where we rely on guidelines and data that have been published.
Thank you for being a part of creating those guidelines, even in a world where it might be difficult to gather all that. So in closing, what words of hope would you like to share with the NET community?
I think the biggest hope is the science, the understanding of the many different types of NETs, and communicating them and getting those treatments and results out to patients. And that's really where I think groups like LACNETs play a huge role. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you for doing what you do. I mean, you started with talking about the impact you can make, and you are making, and you will continue to make with all the work you're doing with guidelines, with all your clinical trials, and trying to answer those unanswered questions. Thank you for addressing all these questions today. It was a fun discussion, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much, Lisa, and thanks for the opportunity. I love being on here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the LACNETs podcast. Go to our website, lacnets.org/podcast, for episode transcripts, resources, and patient stories. We want to thank our podcast supporters, Ipsen, ITM, Advanced Accelerator Applications, Tercera Therapeutics, and Lantheus. For more information about neuroendocrine cancer, go to www.lacnets.org. LACNETs depends on donations to bring you programs such as this podcast. Please consider making a donation at lacnets.org/donate.